I'd also like to let you know that today is the kickoff of our annual stewardship campaign, and we'll hear a little bit more about that later in the service. For now, I'd like to tell you about one other new initiative. We are trying to improve our social hour experience to increase our hospitality. And to that end, we have a social hour steering team that has a vision about how we can be all together contributing to making this a welcoming experience for people of all ages. So during the opening hymn, I have these lovely trays that you might see at an event where hospitality is extended. And there are five cards on them. One says food provider, one says host, one says juice, tea, and coffee makers, one says cleanup, and one says craft activity leader. And our social hour steering team has calculated that if everyone who is a part of the church would volunteer to take one of these jobs, then each person would only have to do one of these jobs two times per year. Small job, twice a year, if we all agree, and that would really help us make sure that our social hour is welcoming for everybody. So please do consider, we'll pass these during the opening hymn. Please consider taking a card. If you have people of all ages in your family, there's something that everybody can participate in. And then hold on to them until the offering. You can put those cards in the offering basket, or there's a basket outside the doors. We light this chalice to remember that every single day is a day when new life begins.
Our call to worship today comes from a poem by David White. Above the mountains, the geese turn into the light again, painting their black silhouettes on an open sky. Sometimes everything has to be inscribed across the heavens so you can find the one line already written inside of you. Sometimes it takes a great sky to find that small, bright, and indescribable wedge of freedom in your own heart. Come, let us worship together.
From the famous German poet Rainer Maria Rilke, from his Book of Hours, words to lead us into a time of silence, meditation, and prayer. How surely gravity's law, strong as an ocean current, takes hold of even the strongest thing and pulls it toward the earth. Each thing, each stone, blossom, child, each thing is held in place. Only we in our arrogance push out beyond what we belong to for some empty freedom. If we surrendered to Earth's intelligence, we could rise uprooted like trees. Instead, we entangle ourselves in knots of our own making and struggle, lonely and confused. So, like children, we begin again to learn from the things because they are in God's heart that have never left God. And this is what the things can teach us. To fall, patiently to trust our heaviness. Even a bird has to do that before it can fly. Will you join with me now in the spirit of prayer? Spring is surely coming. We see it now in the flight of the migrating birds, in the tendrils of green poking up through the earth. It's seem so fragile this spring. Fragile tendrils, fragile birds, so they seem. But the truth is, there is strength and power that will not be stopped. Spring is coming, rising green. The birds are singing their song. May we hear it. May we see it. And connect in our own hearts to the rising of hope, the flight of possibility, and the persistence of love, always coming, often fragile, but so powerful. May we see, may we hear, and join our lives in the journey. Amen.
Reading today is a poem by Rabbi Rachel Barenblatt, and she heads her poem with a quote from Exodus 12:34, which is in your bulletin, in your order of service. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls wrapped in the cloaks upon their shoulders. And here's the poem. You'll need to travel light. Take what you can carry, a book, a poem, a battered tin cup, your child strapped to your chest, clutching your necklace in one hot, possessive fist. So the dough isn't ready. So your heart isn't ready. You haven't said goodbye to the places where you hid as a child, to the friends who aren't interested in the journey, to the graves you've tended. But if you wait until you feel fully ready, you may never take the leap at all. And infinity is calling you forth out of this birth canal and into the future's wide expanse. Learn to improvise flat cakes without the yeast. Learn to read new alphabets. Wear God like a cloak and stride forth with confidence. You won't know where you're going, But you have the words of our sages and the songs of our mothers, the inspiration wrapped in your kneading bowl. Trust that what you carry will sustain you and take the first step out the door. You abound in blessings. God, creator of the universe, who sustains us with living water, may we, like the children of Israel leaving Egypt, be guarded and nurtured and kept alive in the wilderness. And may you give us eyes to see that the journey itself holds the promise of redemption.
True wisdom comes in understanding that you are sometimes the prison and sometimes the key. This comes from a young adult poet and author, Jonathan Jaina, and it strikes me as deeply true. Sometimes we are both the prison and the key, or if not the prison, at least conspirators in our own imprisonment. I'm thinking about all the ways we entangle ourselves in knots of our own making, as Rilke puts it. I'm thinking of lies woven so intricately it seems impossible to find our way out, and of the burdens of resentment carried so long that they seem to become a part of ourselves. I'm thinking about devotion to destructive habits and damaging relationships of all kinds, as well as dedication to cynicism and sarcasm as a way of checking out and being above it all. I've gotten tangled up in some of these knots at various points in my life. Perhaps you have too. Life is messy, and we all lose our way sometimes. Each of these wayward paths, lies spun and defended, resentments nurtured and tended, destructive habits and damaging relationships protected, the embrace of cynicism and scorn, each of these can become like a prison if we fail to find a way toward health. And sometimes we do fail. We fail when we refuse to make ourselves vulnerable enough to own up to our own mistakes and reflect on our stumbling. We fail when we reject the possibility that we can take steps to return to right relationship with ourselves, with one another, and with the whole. We become the prison when we convince ourselves that brokenness, burden, damage, distrust, despair is all there is and all there can be. We become the key when we remember that something more and better is always possible. Aviva Zornberg is a contemporary Torah scholar living in Israel. She's the author of several commentaries on the Torah, including a book on Exodus called The Particulars of Rapture. The book of Exodus tells the story of the liberation of the Hebrew people. The people need liberating because a new king rose up in Egypt who did not remember Joseph and the way in which he helped save the Egyptians from famine. All the new king knew was that these Israelites outnumbered the Egyptians, and he feared what would happen if they ever rose up and became disloyal. So the king, also known as Pharaoh, instituted a system of oppression. Pharaoh decreed that the Hebrew people should be enslaved and forced into hard labor. The prison into which the Hebrew people were forced was quite literal and not of their own making. And yet, Zornberg says, the story of liberation that is told in the book of Exodus has many layers. Next Sunday, the service will be about that layer that is not of our own making, and the liberation theology that teaches how people can rise up against oppression. But today, I want to consider what the Czech leader Václav Havel says, which is that in any kind of oppressive regime, there is a process by which the people themselves become a part of the system of oppression. They don't just accept the role, he says, they almost become that role. One of the ways I have learned to describe this process is through the language of internalization. In contemporary anti-racism work, for example, one of the things that I have learned is that we internalize racism. White people internalize racism as a construct of racial superiority, and people of color internalize racism as a construct of racial inferiority. How we internalize racism differs depending upon our identity and our experience, but we all internalize it to some degree. What we share is the experience of not being truly free. And as we have seen increasingly in the current campaign for president, some people actually want it that way, for us to not be truly free. All of us. And that was very clearly true in the time of the Exodus. The text tells us that the Egyptians were ruthless taskmasters, eager to beat the people down in an effort to consolidate power for themselves, as is so often the case, and maybe is the case now for us too. The Hebrew people were victims of hard labor. Our experience is not of hard labor, but we too see those who are trying to consolidate power for themselves at the expense of others. Exodus is a story which we can relate to and which people throughout time have been able to relate to. The Hebrew people were the victims of hard labor, casual cruelty, and ever-present threat. But the prison was not of their own making. There truly was an external authority keeping them bound. So how were they to imagine a pathway to liberation? Zornberg says that one answer lies in Midrash. Midrash is a compendium of ancient commentary on the Torah, and there are many collections of Midrash. She cites one from the 5th century, a primary Midrashic text, and she cites a story from that text that she calls the mirror story. You find that when Israel were in harsh labor in Egypt, Midrash begins, Pharaoh decreed against them that they should not sleep at home or have any relations with their wives. Said Rabbi Shimeon Bar Chalafta, what did the daughters of Israel do? They would go down to the river with these little buckets, and they'd dip the buckets into the water in which they would find fish. And they'd take the fish back and sell some of it and cooked some of it. And with the proceeds from what they sold, they would buy wine. And they'd take the wine and the cooked fish to the fields where their husbands lay, and feed them, and offer them drink. And then when they were sated, they'd recline in the fields and pull out these mirrors and hold it up before themselves. And she would say to her husband, I am more comely than you. And the husband would look into the mirror and say, no, I am more comely than you. And by this process, they would accustom themselves to desire, the text says. They would accustom themselves to desire, and from the midst of their harsh labor, they raised up all the hosts because they bore children. Two at a time, others said they bore 12 at a time, and others still said 600,000 children at a time. And all of this from the mirrors. Zornberg says that the play with the mirrors is a kind of game in which the women are challenging the men to see their own beauty. The life-affirming acts of noticing their own beauty and remembering desire helps the people to feel that they are capable of giving birth to children, yes, but also to possibility. And that sense of possibility, Zornberg writes, includes the possibility of freedom, of infiniteness, of unpredictability, which such multiple births suggests. And she continues, it's all done with mirrors. The mirror represents fantasy, but from the point of view of Midrash and from the point of view of God, who supports the women's activities, it takes an act of this kind, a performative act of whimsy and imagination, of looking at things not quite straight in order to open up possibility. Exodus tells the story of liberation. In the beginning of the story, the people are not spiritually ready for liberation. Midrash suggests that one of the ways that they get ready is by allowing themselves to notice beauty. Imagine, one of the ways they get ready to be liberated is by allowing themselves to notice beauty. and making themselves vulnerable enough to desire life. She says that we can untangle the knots by learning from the things that are in God's heart. That's Rilke's language. Maybe there's another way of talking about the transformation that happened with those mirrors. Learn what's in God's heart, and then trust enough to fall into that love that is in God's heart. Fall into a larger love, which is the source of hope and the sustainer of life, known by many names. That love can save us, even if we don't know how to help save ourselves. Rabbi Rachel Barenblatt wisely cautions that if we wait until we're fully ready and we do the math and it seems 100% certain that we will succeed, we'll never go. It's frightening to go. It's frightening to leap. It's frightening to fall, to trust in futures we cannot know and possibilities which we cannot ultimately control. But we can imagine. We can imagine love. We can imagine love calling us on. We can imagine more life and life calling us on. We can imagine beauty and desire and hope calling us on. We can imagine, and this is the key. Holy imagination is a key to help us unlock the prison. When the people set out on the journey, they don't have it all worked out. They seized a moment of possibility and leapt. They crossed the Red Sea, following after Moses, and they made it safely to the other side. But when the chase was over and they had a chance to reflect on their astonishing new reality and freedom, the people began to entertain doubts. They were hungry, and at least in Egypt they had food. They were thirsty, and at least in Egypt they had something to drink. They were afraid, and at least in Egypt they knew how life went, even though they didn't like it. I have a volume of poetry a friend gave me from a poet named Pamela Sneed, and the volume is called Imagine Being More Afraid of Freedom Than Slavery. The Israelites could imagine that. Freedom was new and uncertain and sometimes incredibly scary. Back in Egypt, at least they knew what to expect. What this tells us is that the work of unlocking the prison doesn't always happen at once. We don't just turn the key and poof, we are free. Physically, they were free. Emotionally and spiritually, they had more work to do. But here's another key. The journey itself holds the promise of redemption. That's how Rabbi Barenblatt ends her poem about being ready. Sometimes the journey is part of what we need to unlock the prison or untangle the knot. It may not be comfortable or even feel particularly secure, but the journey itself can be transformational. For the Israelites, liberation was found in the journey of 40 years wandering through the desert. It was a process of unlocking the door. For one of us, liberation might be found in deciding to tell the truth and turn toward repair. We might find it in deciding it's finally time to let go of the weight of resentments, or in deciding to change destructive habits or damaging relationships and turn toward healing, or in surrendering to the vulnerability of caring enough to engage instead of shielding ourselves with cynicism and sarcasm. For us, liberation might be being honest with ourselves about what we do and do not want for our lives and daring to imagine a life more whole. Talking about those mirrors, Zornberg says, the people needed first to name the pain with which they suffered. They had to own up to their own reality and the damage it was doing. These must be uttered first, she says, so that the mirrors can be mobilized in contradictory, visionary love. I think that's fabulous. The mirrors can be mobilized in contradictory, visionary love. It isn't easy, but one of the keys we can trust to help unlock the prisons is visionary love. And so I'll end now with this poem from Stephen Levine, a contemporary poet who I think says it so well. If prayer would do it, I'd pray. If reading esteemed thinkers would do it, I'd be halfway through the patriarchs. If discourse would do it, I'd be sitting with His Holiness every moment He was free. If contemplation would do it, I'd have translated the periodic table to hermit poems, converting matter to spirit. If even fighting would do it, I'd already be a black belt. If anything other than love could do it, I'd have done it already and saved the hardest for last. The hardest, perhaps, but also one of the surest paths we could ever take. Maybe so, and amen. Marian Yeagler is one of the leaders of our stewardship campaign, and as we kick off our campaign today and the ushers come forward, Marian has a word of introduction.
The annual stewardship campaign, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, raises most of our daily operating funds, and those costs have been going up. We're hoping that if you're able to, you'll consider raising your pledge. This church is totally self-supporting financially, so all of those programs are funded by us. And like I said, we hope that you'll be able to increase your pledge if possible. There are, if you'll notice, pledge cards in the pews if you didn't receive one. We'll also have them at the stewardship table downstairs. After you complete it, you can put it in the offering basket or bring it to us at the stewardship table. We also have brochures down there which explain the budget this year. The stewardship team consists of me, Marian Yeagler, Jen and Teresa Walton-Fizette, and Claudia Miller, with the help of Sandy Eaglin, our treasurer, and of course, Reverend Melissa and Mary Beth Hannon, our office administrator. And at this time and every Sunday for the next 6 weeks, we're going to have people sharing with you why they pledge and what this church means to them. Will the ushers please come forward at this time? And Kathy Walker and Saul Flannery will be sharing with you.
Saul and I started attending the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent 13 and a half years ago. As a couple of atheist transplants from Kansas, we thought we might make some new friends. We thought having a community here might be good for any future children. And we got those things, but we got so much more than that.
We help support the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent with our annual financial pledge because this church and this community has given us the opportunity to minister to others in ways we didn't know we could, and to be ministered by others in ways we didn't know we needed. To be a part of something bigger than ourselves. As new members, we were quickly integrated into this community when we began to volunteer, not only our treasure, but our time.
As our commitment has grown, we have tried, not always successfully, to grow our pledge because we know our stewardship to this church is what makes those opportunities for ourselves and for our daughter possible. We are grateful for what this community has given us, and we are blessed to give back what we can.
As we go this week, we are surely to hear once again the voices of hate, but we are people who know the redemptive power of love. So let us lend our voices to that liberating force. Go in peace.